This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Today, we bring you Food for Thought, a report on food in the developing world. We take a look at who has it, who doesn't, and how it can break down age-old barriers. In Mexico, animal protein takes on a whole new meaning.
Se prepara con ajo, sal y limón.
I like them. You prepare them with garlic, salt, and lime. If they're big, you boil them for an hour, and that way they come out delicious.
It's grasshopper grub. Plus, in Israel, Jews and Arabs come together at the Yafa Cafe. And steering clear of deli belly, what reporters eat when they're on the road.
I'd been warned to eat everything during my four-day stay in this village, lest I offend my host. But everyone has a gastronomic limit, and giant rat, apparently, is mine.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. When it comes to dinner time, many of us have a choice. Will it be pasta, fish, or meat and potatoes? In developing countries, the question isn't usually about what to eat, but whether there's anything to eat at all. According to the World Food Program, 1 in 6 people in the developing world goes hungry every day. Rosa and David Martinez might have been among them. They were subsistence farmers in Oaxaca, Mexico, but they're old now and they can't work their land anymore. So they could have been in real trouble if they hadn't come across a surprising new crop, Conrad Fox reports.
Rosa Martinez shuffles about her house, leaning on an old plastic chair. She lost one of her legs 3 years ago to gangrene, a result of diabetes she didn't treat properly. She couldn't afford the medicines. Meanwhile, her husband, 66-year-old David, has a back injury that prohibits him from working his fields. We can't do it, he says. We're too old to work. So the couple eke out a living by selling pigs and a traditional beverage of fermented corn. But last year, they also joined in a new venture that's helping them earn a bit more money.
It's so easy. We just weigh the grasshoppers and lay them out on plastic.
Yes, the Martinez are in the grasshopper business. Between September and December, when grasshoppers are at their most plump, locals bring them bags of the dead insects, which the couple spread out on the floor of their garage to dry.
Well, the only thing is, you have to make sure you keep turning them over so they dry. Otherwise, they go bad and start stinking the place up.
Those grasshoppers end up in stores across Mexico. Last year, this job earned the couple $200. That's a month's wages for them. And they're not the only people in the village benefiting. Half a mile away, in an alfalfa field, 22-year-old Jose Luis Lopez sweeps a net through the grass, bagging grasshoppers. The insect is considered a plague by some, but not to Lopez.
Me gusta. Sí. Se prepara con ajo, sal y limón.
I like them. You prepare them with garlic, salt, and lime, and then put them over a fire for half an hour, if they're small.
Y si son grandes, una hora se ponen.
If they're big, you boil them for an hour, and that way they come out delicious.
Since he was 7, Lopez has been helping his family catch grasshoppers to eat and to sell. It's a practice that's long provided a fallback income for the poorest people in this village. But to make that money, they have to take an expensive bus ride to Oaxaca City and sell the dried insects door to door. But now, thanks to a group of young entrepreneurs, Jose Luis will just leave his raw grasshoppers at David and Rosa's house. For each kilo, he'll get 90 pesos, or $9, about the going rate if he'd sold them himself in the city, but without all the costs that entails. David and Rosa will get 10 pesos per kilo to store them, and then eventually, they'll end up here.
Es el de estar secuela el chapulín, ahorita lo estamos haciendo muy manualmente.
In this small garage in Oaxaca City, Hugo Sandoval stands watch over an industrial food mixer. He's preparing a salsa made of tomatoes, chilies, and the ground-up legs of grasshoppers. His company also makes grasshopper-flavored salt and crispy grasshopper snacks. During grasshopper season, he heads out to San Juan Tetiapac once a week to pick up a fresh consignment of grasshoppers from David and Rosa, leaving a payment for them and the 50 or so grasshopper catchers who supply them. Sandoval packages his products in attractive bottles and bags that would look right at home on any Western supermarket shelf. In fact, he soon hopes to be making big profits selling to the Latino market in the U.S., although he's not ruling out other customers, both there and in Europe.
Aquí en mi casa conozco a mucha gente de gringos. Y ellos llegan y salen, no lo quieren ni agarrar, ¿no? Saltan, ¿no?
I know gringos who are like, no, ew. A lot of people see them and jump higher than the grasshoppers themselves. But then they start trying them. They eat a whole bucket full.
The World Vision Report was skeptical. So we asked some European tourists on the streets of Oaxaca City if they'd care to try a crispy snack grasshopper.
Oh, I'm vegetarian, so...
Can I see you eat one?
I'll take one.
You'll take one?
Yeah.
I have to take one then.
Crisp? Salty?
Not that bad?
No.
I'll try it. Why not? I'll be adventurous. Yeah, fine.
Yeah.
Kind of like dried sun-dried tomatoes.
Reminds me a bit of a nut, actually, the aftertaste.
Based on this unscientific survey, it seems Sandoval's dream of making grasshoppers the biggest money-making crop in Oaxaca and helping some poor families earn a living along the way is perhaps not so far-fetched. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in San Juan Teitiapac, Mexico.
Grasshoppers might not be the food of choice for many of us, but when you're hungry, you can't afford to be picky about the food you eat. So imagine what people are driven to eat when they're starving. New York Times reporter Donald McNeil wrote an article on what starving people do to survive. He told us it was a photograph on the front page of his paper that caught his attention.
The story was about suffering in Haiti in the wake of fighting. And there was a photograph of biscuits made out of, that looked sort of appetizing. They were sort of swirls of white dough baking in the sun. But when you looked at the caption, it turned out that they were made out of butter, salt, and dirt. And one of my editors came to me and said, have you ever seen anything like this? Do you know the story behind these biscuits? And I'd never been to Haiti. And I said, no, I don't know anything. And then she said, look, could we do a piece on what people do all around the world when they're starving or when they're right on the verge of starvation? What do they do to cope? And that piqued my interest. And I said, sure, I'll look into it.
It's a strange story to do, isn't it? Because it's almost intriguing because it's so creative, but it's really tragic.
No, it's a horrible situation. I mean, people get on the verge of starvation and they have to turn to plants that they wouldn't have considered before, or things you might not normally think to eat, like locusts in Mozambique, like the tiny little kernels inside marula fruit that you can crack and poke out with a pin. There are also foods that people sort of eat that are somewhere between a traditional snack and somewhere between a starvation food. For instance, you can get skewers of roasted mice in Malawi. When you drive along rural roads, you'll find kids coming out of the fields with mice they've caught in the field and put on a skewer and roasted over the fire. But that's not really a starvation food. That's sort of a rural snack. When people are desperate, they do things like break into anthills or termite mounds, and they take out all the tiny grains that the ants have collected and eat those.
Now, some of the things that surprised me most in your article were that it wasn't just bushes and seeds people were eating, but they are eating non-edible things.
Chairs, for example. Well, that was a story that somebody sent me from a World Food Program worker who worked in Angola in the early 1990s. And he had seen a father who came home with a leather and wood chair and told his family that if we don't die today, we're going to be able to survive for 4 more days. And he pulled the leather off the chair and soaked it for day and a night in order to soften the leather and try to leach out the tanning chemicals. And then he boiled it and made what he called lamb soup out of it. And I spoke to a woman who said that she had heard stories about people eating furniture in the Soviet Union in the 1930s during the starving times there. You know, leather is edible under extreme circumstances.
But leather certainly isn't nutritious.
Dirt biscuits aren't nutritious either. It fills up your stomach for a while.
You had another story about Eritrean women. What do they do when they're hungry?
Eritrean women apparently strap flat stones to their stomach to try to keep the hunger pangs away. And all over the world, I've heard this story a number of times, that you will find mothers who, when the kids are hungry, will put a pot of water on the fire and drop some stones in and tell the kids that the food is cooking and it's not ready yet. It'll be a little while longer, and you just hope the kids fall asleep while they're waiting for the food to cook.
How many people are we talking about that actually have to resort to these kinds of coping mechanisms when they're hungry?
many millions of people go to bed hungry each night. But there's a difference between going to bed hungry and going to bed starving. And unfortunately, starving is one of those things that isn't caused merely by the lack of food. I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the article is that economic historians think that since the year 1500, roughly, there has never been a famine that is caused entirely by a lack of food, by crop failure or pests. There's always been some political component to it. People have been allowed to die, and that's one of the great tragedies in the modern world, is that there always is food there. There's just sometimes people prevent it from getting to the people who need it.
Mm-hmm. Donald, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Donald McNeil writes for the New York Times. To read his article, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. As we just heard, starving people sometimes have to resort to eating things like furniture or dirt. It's difficult to imagine that as we stroll down our supermarket aisles with shelves filled to overflowing. The World Food Program sees the problem up close. It delivers food to millions of hungry people each year. And now, the organization wants kids to understand exactly how they do that. More on the story from the World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber.
Thanks again for coming at such short notice. I'll get straight to the point. A major crisis has developed in the Indian Ocean, on the island of Shay Lan. A crack squad has been selected to head up the crisis team.
I'm part of that crack mission. Within seconds, I'm up in a helicopter scouting the dusty terrain to deliver food aid. If Shay Lan sounds, well, unfamiliar, it should. It's an imaginary country, part of a free downloadable computer game called Food Force. The World Food Program released the game in 2005. Justin Roche is a spokesperson.
Hunger still continues to kill more and more people than it did 10 years ago. We felt that the best way to educate children was using a format that is becoming more and more popular, and that is really the video game format.
So far, more than 5 million people have downloaded the hour-long game. Many have posted positive reviews on the organization's website. But here's a real test. The game is geared for 9 to 13-year-olds. Siblings Jeremy and Abby Oceans are 9 and 11.
Over there.
I see them,
in front of your nose.
Abby says she wasn't crazy about all the information in the game. Still, she learned something.
There is so much that we can do in the world, and that this game helps us realize it, but it's fun at the same time. And even though it sounds kind of dorky, it's not as fun.
The Food Force website includes descriptions of real-life food crises. And there are lesson plans so teachers can use the game in the classroom. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber.
Good work! You managed to get all the food and truck safely through in good time. Want to try again? Or...
Coming up, the phrase fast food takes on new meaning in Mumbai. Stay with us for lunch in the busy Indian city. That's just ahead on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Workers in Mumbai, India, enjoy a unique kind of fast food. It's not the mass-produced, fat-laden stuff we're used to. This food is cooked fresh at home. It's then rushed to offices and workplaces across town before it even has time to get cold. That's thanks to the lunchbox men, or as they're known in Mumbai, the dabbawalas. For well over a century, this lunch delivery service has been run by poor, mostly illiterate workers. Reporter Peter Aronson follows the journey of one particular lunch.
Sunita Shuram Kesarkar puts the finishing touches on her husband's lunch, a vegetarian meal which consists of
varan, bhat, chapati, bhaji.
Rice, dal, chapati, and vegetables, she says. She carefully packs each course into a metal bowl that stacks together and fits in a traditional Indian lunchbox called a tiffin. Her husband left for work across town hours ago, but she'll send his lunch with a dabbawala, or lunchbox man, who'll be here any minute. There are 5,000 of them in Mumbai, each carrying dozens of metal lunchboxes at a time.
This dabbawala person is very important for our family, because if the dabbawala tiffin man was not there, I would wake up at 5 a.m. and prepare the tiffin, because my husband leaves at 7 in the morning. but the service is available, so that's why I can start at 10 o'clock.
Why not just buy something for lunch? Well, nearly all Indians prefer home cooking, but there's another reason why dabawalas are so important in this city. Mumbai residents commute to work on severely overcrowded trains. They're so packed, they don't really even have room for lunch boxes.
You'll have a taste of our house.
Of course, a reporter can't visit their home without being offered some food.
It's very good.
The family's dabawala finally arrives. But Sunil Sabajaruti is nearly an hour late. The 24-year-old has been a dabawala for 8 years. I dash out with him. He hangs the lunchbox on his bicycle along with about 24 others and pedals off for his next stop. He's carrying what's known as a Gandhi hat, a cap that resembles what burger flippers wear in the U.S.
Sunil has put on his white Gandhi hat, which is kind of his right-of-way sign. He's going the wrong way down the street. But since he's a dabawala, no policeman would stop him.
Dabawalas are free to do whatever's necessary to get those lunches delivered on time. After collecting all the lunches on his route, he races to the nearest train station.
Hello.
Here, the lunchboxes are sorted at a furious pace. They'll typically change hands at least 3 times before being delivered to their final destination. Usually, Mr. Kesarkar's lunch travels by train, but maybe because the first dabawala was late, this time it'll travel by bicycle relay. All lunches must arrive by 1 o'clock. The dabawala's system is a model of efficiency. It moves 200,000 lunches each day across a 37-mile radius of Mumbai, and they do all that in just 3 hours, without the aid of computers or barcodes. Actually, most dabawalas can't read, so they use a simplified system of markings painted on each lunchbox to indicate the route it should travel and its final destination. Their process earned a coveted international certification for reliability known as Six Sigma, which means they only make one mistake in every 16 million transactions. Manish Tripathi is the honorary director of the Mumbai Dabawalas. He says one of the things that accounts for their success is their core philosophy, which reflects both their Hindu upbringing and their work ethic.
Now, every dabawala has certain beliefs which guides him wherever he's working. So these beliefs are work is worship, serving people is serving God, delivering food is the best service to the humanity, time is money, and unity is power.
Tripathi says dabawalas scrape by a meager living on their $100-and-some a month average salary.
They don't have good houses, they don't have access to the medical facilities. The good news is that some of the dabawalas who are working very hard, their kids have got higher education, and now the status of their family is getting better and better.
Back out on the street, the lunch Mrs. Kesarkar packed this morning is just moments away from its final destination.
My name is Shivram Pandurang Kesarkar. I'm a florist man since last 30 years.
At his flower shop in Mumbai's Kolaba neighborhood, Mr. Kesarkar is waiting for the dabawala to deliver his lunchbox, or tiffin, just as he's been doing for more than a quarter century.
And no mistake, that is true. He's not giving your tiffin to me, my tiffin to another fellow. He's not. No mistake like that.
Finally, a dabawala hands Kesarkar his lunch, still warm and fresh, and quickly dashes back out again without a word.
So you have
dal rice.
Dal and rice.
Chapatis.
Chapatis.
And
some kind of vegetables. You have vegetables.
Vegetables.
Enjoy your lunch.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much, sir. And that's it. He's off to deliver his next dabba.
He'll be back in a little while, though, to pick up the empty lunchbox, which will make the same trip in reverse later this afternoon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Mumbai, India.
By the way, in case you were wondering how the dabawalas get their lunches, Peter tells us they carry their tins from home themselves.
Fat is beautiful, at least in some parts of the world. In some societies, those extra pounds aren't something to complain about. They're a sign of wealth and social status. So much so that in the African country of Mauritania, girls used to be force-fed to the point of obesity. But recently, that tradition has started to change. Lisa Bryant reports.
42-year-old Fatma Sidi Mohammed didn't eat Oreo cookies and Pringles when she was a little girl, living in a tiny village in southeastern Mauritania. But she did drink milk, lots of it.
I don't want to recall that experience. It was something we had to do. In the morning, we had to drink something like 20 liters of milk, at noon as well.
Sidi Mohammed consumed milk from morning until night. Later, she was forced to eat mountains of lamb and other solid food. Sometimes she'd throw up after the binges. Sometimes she'd try to avoid eating altogether. But by the time she was a teenager, she says, she was so enormous that even walking slowly was an effort. In Mauritania, girls from the ruling Arab caste, like Fatma Sidi Mohammed, have long been fattened up to be beautiful.
Often, families start fattening a girl at 9 or 10 years old. So early on, people have the impression she is older, 17 or 18. That means she is ready for marriage.
Force feeding here is closely tied with traditional daily life. 40 years ago, most Mauritanians were nomadic, and the country's affluent Arabs owned slaves. That meant wealthy women like Sidi Mohammed had little to do besides eat and lie around. As one Moor saying goes, the glory of a man is measured by the fatness of his woman. As a result, obesity among Mauritanian women has led to soaring cases of heart disease and other health problems. A few years ago, the Mauritanian government launched a major campaign against force-feeding girls. They even got imams or Muslim preachers on board to tell people that these practices were not endorsed by Islam. And the campaign is making headway. A few decades ago, up to 70% of Mauritanian girls were force-fed. Today, only about 1 in 10 are. And there are other reasons why this practice may be falling out of favor. Drought in the encroaching Sahara Desert have forced many Mauritanians to give up their nomadic lifestyle and move to cities like Nouakchott. Here, many women work. 35-year-old Maimouna Mint Mubarak sells produce at a local market, and she certainly isn't fat. A mother of seven, Mubarak says she can't afford to sit around and eat. Neither can her daughters.
I don't want my daughters to gain a lot of weight. It would be impossible for them to work. Women in the past were so fat they couldn't even stand up.
Poverty and government pressure aren't the only reasons for Mauritania's changing weight standards. Glossy women's magazines and satellite television have arrived in Africa, bringing with them a new, skinnier Western definition of beauty. So today, men like 35-year-old Kante Omar Haruna don't view obesity as a top criteria in finding a wife.
When she's skinny, she's more active, more cool. That's what makes a good wife, but not too skinny. Then she's too thin. People will say her husband doesn't care for her.
Despite changing attitudes towards force-feeding, a recent United Nations study found that the majority of women here still believe it makes girls more beautiful. So campaigns against it continue, including those from non-governmental organizations like the group Espoir, or Hope. The NGO offers literacy and health classes, as well as lending programs for poor women. It's run by Fatma Sidi Mohammed, the woman who was forced to drink so much milk as a little girl. Today, Sidi Mohammed is divorced. She's attractive, still a big woman, but certainly not obese. Her 22-year-old daughter, Wafa, works as an accountant. She's average size and unmarried.
I always tell her, Wafa, don't eat much of that. I tell her to do sports. She still doesn't want to be too thin, but I want her to avoid what I experienced. I suffered when I was fat, so I tell her to stop eating. Just stop.
Sidi Mohammed exercises regularly and watches her diet. She'd still like to lose a few more pounds, but she says she has no interest in squeezing into a size 6. That may be the dream of Western women, she says, but not of the women of her country. For the World Vision Report, I'm Lisa Bryant in New Wakshot, Mauritania. Now, on a more serious note, hunger kills more people than AIDS, malaria, and TB combined. And though most people who suffer from hunger live in developing countries, the problem exists right here in our own backyards. According to government statistics, one out of every five children goes to bed hungry at night. That's in a country where more than 96 billion pounds of food are wasted every year. Stan Curtis is trying to do something about that. He got the idea for USA Harvest when he was standing in a cafeteria line one day and saw a man throw a pan of perfectly good green beans into the trash. Stan Curtis takes up the story from there.
This young man replaced the pan that I was going to order from with a heaping pan full of green beans. And I turned to my wife and I said, gosh, sweetie, I wonder what happened to those green beans. One minute I was going to order from them, the next they disappeared. So after dinner, I asked the manager to come over and I told him that story. And I said, what happened to the green beans? He said, well, you know, our customers think that if they're ordering from a pan full of anything, that the fruit is fresher. He didn't answer the question. So after he got done, I assured him the meal was fine. And I said, now, what happened to the green beans? And he said, the health department says if we take them off the steam table, we can't put them back on. So we threw them away. 3 days later, in Louisville, Kentucky, there was a story about an increase in the population of homeless and those less fortunate in Louisville. And this was in December of 1986. And so the idea was, gee, I wonder if those people would like those green beans. And that was almost 14 billion pounds of food ago.
How did you get those green beans into the mouths of the homeless in your city?
You know, I'm a businessman, okay? And Peggy, I was probably living what a lot of people would perceive as the life of a perfect American capitalist. I was a retired professional athlete. I was driving nice cars. I was playing golf. So I called the six largest feeding facilities in Louisville, Kentucky at the time, and this was in early January of 1987. And I got them all in a room, and I said, I need to ask you two questions. Number one, do you have enough food to feed people who are less fortunate that you serve? And the answer was a resounding no from each one of them. The second question was, if somebody brought you food free of charge to give to those less fortunate, would you take it? Would you be able to accept it? The answer was yes, resoundingly. And I said, thank you very much. Go.
And then you were on a roll. Then you knew what you needed to do. But I've always heard or thought that health departments will not allow restaurants to give opened or handled food away, that you can't redistribute that food.
You're exactly right.
So how do you do it?
Well, you're missing a process, though. A restaurant, for example, that serves in a cafeteria line, what they prepare is not what you look at. What they prepare is not only what you see when you go through the line, but shelves and shelves and pans full of it behind the wall. The stuff that has not made it to the cafeteria line is stuff that is prepared but not served.
So that's what you're talking about.
You got it.
So you knew you couldn't take the food that had been prepared and served, but you guys started going after the food that had been prepared and not even placed out or not been prepared at all.
Exactly. Exactly. And the fact is that one of the biggest sins in this country when you're in the restaurant business is to run out of food, of anything on the menu. So, you know, let's say that you as a restaurant owner start the day preparing 300 baked potatoes and the weather turns bad and only 116 baked potatoes are ordered in the course of a day. You got 184 baked potatoes left over. Now, if you maintain a certain quality of control, those baked potatoes are done. You're not going to use them for potato soup. You're not going to use them for potato skins. They are done. That 184 baked potatoes is what Harvest picks up in this country to take to those less fortunate.
So you're doing this in dozens of cities around the country now.
127.
127 cities. How many people do you have on your staff?
Zero.
How do you pull this off?
We do not ask for money. We ask for food. We depend upon volunteers. You know, this organization, we've got now nationwide about 130,000, 131,000 volunteers in 127 cities. These people do it because they care about the quality of life in their community. They do it because as a volunteer, they get something out of it. And frankly, they're doing something big for something good, Peggy.
Stan, you won an award called the America's Award, which is known as the Nobel Prize for Goodness.
You know, when you get in a position where, you know, I'm this is not about me. This is, and frankly, it's all about the food. It's all about the food. I thank God every day for getting up, number one. Number two, I pray that I can help get some food to some people or help somebody's life every day.
All right, Stan Curtis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Peggy.
That was Stan Curtis, founder of USA Harvest. He spoke to us from a studio in Louisville, Kentucky.
My filet mignon is a little overdone, but I'm gonna eat it anyway. The chef is new, I don't know what to do. Somebody please tell me what to say. I've been coming here for such a long, long time, and I like to have my steak a certain way, with a special sauce and something on the side, and a nice clean napkin on my tray. Should I send it back? Will the waiter attack? Will the chef spit in my food this day? Should I send it back? Will the waiter attack? Will the chef spit in my food this day?
Coming up, changing a culture one kitchen at a time. In India, untouchables come in from the cold. And in Israel, Jews and Arabs meet over coffee. That's ahead after a short break. You're listening to the World Vision Report.
With a special sauce and something on the side and a nice clean napkin on my tray. Should I send it back? Will the waiter attack? Will the chef spit in my food this day? Should I send it back? Will the waiter attack? Will the chef spit in my food this day?
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Welcome back. In India, untouchables are not allowed in the kitchen, especially if the kitchen belongs to someone higher up in the caste system. Untouchables have occupied the lowest rung of the social ladder for thousands of years. As a result, they're stuck doing jobs like cleaning latrines or sweeping the streets. The government is trying to change the system, so far with little success. But Miranda Kennedy reports that in some pockets of urban India, small changes are being made.
35-year-old Nisha is an untouchable. She belongs to the Gujar caste. Traditionally, members of this caste have collected garbage and buried the dead. Nisha identifies herself so completely with her caste that when you ask her her name, she says,
Kailash Nisha Gujar. Gujar.
Kailash Nisha Gujar. Kailash is her husband's first name. Nisha is her given name, and she uses her caste as her last name. Her husband belongs to the same caste, and so does pretty much everyone she knows. Nisha says she never went to school because her parents figured it was a waste of money for an untouchable girl. Instead, she and her sisters supported the family by selling coal in the market. When she got married at 17, she was expected to take her mother-in-law's job as a cleaner. Nisha became the fourth generation of untouchable women to work here in the home of the Wagley family. They're well-to-do Brahmins, the highest caste.
When my family first started working for this family, we were forbidden to enter the house. We collected their garbage, so Brahmins considered us impure. And if an untouchable was allowed inside, she'd have to sweep herself out of the room.
But that extreme discrimination has changed now in many Indian homes. In this house, attitudes changed so drastically that 5 years ago, the Wagleys hired Nisha to do the job that Brahmins consider most sacred, cook their food. This afternoon, Nisha's preparing a rice and meat stew for the evening meal. Nisha's boss, Gayatri Wagley, says back in her grandmother's day, that would have been unthinkable.
You didn't allow the
untouchables to come into the house, and that's the way everybody behaved, and so she behaved that way. But when mom got married, she became the head of the house, so to speak. She felt that, you know, it was all right for her to come into the house, and by then, like, a lot of other people were doing it. And when I came into the house, it was like, because she never had any problems, neither did I.
Gayatri and the rest of the family decided they trusted Nisha, and so they were willing to start breaking down India's strong caste barriers. Now they pay her triple what they paid her as a cleaner, about $70 a month. But for Nisha, the change is about more than the money.
When they offered me the job of cook, I said, are you sure you want to have an untouchable in the kitchen? When they said yes, it felt good.
Nisha says her husband and her community treat her with more respect now, but she's still the exception to the rule among untouchables. Her husband still makes a pittance working as a garbage collector, and so does almost everyone else she knows. For the World Vision Report, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Bombay.
There's a cafe in the Israeli city of Jaffa where there's more than food on the menu. There's an opportunity to meet and mix with people from the other side of a political and religious divide. Daniel Estrin discovered the cafe when he first arrived in Israel a few years ago. He sent us this page from his reporter's notebook.
If you take a walk down the main drag in Jaffa, you might be convinced that this ancient city has seen its better days. Apartment fronts are crumbling, and except for a few fishing boats and art galleries priced for tourists, Jaffa's mostly a slum. But on one side street, tucked in a corner behind an ice cream shop, there's a chic white awning above glass doors. They open into a small cafe called Jaffa. There are a few tables and chairs and a small kitchen. One wall is covered with neatly stacked books in Arabic and Hebrew, an unusual sight in this country of divisions. On your first visit, Arab co-owner Michelle will undoubtedly tell you the story about the Palestinian woman who ordered the Jaffa salad. It's a traditional Arab salad served with a side of challah, the sweetbread Jews bake for the Sabbath. The Palestinian woman fell in love with the challah. Coexistence through food, Michelle beams. Michelle owns a cafe with Dina, who's Jewish. She brings the challah bread straight from her home oven. The pair doesn't get too excited about their unique establishment. Some days there are more Jews that come, some days there are more Arabs, some days they even sit with each other. Dina and Michelle don't keep score. They just think this kind of place should exist. One Friday afternoon, I was eating a bowl of mujadra, a Palestinian rice and lentil dish, when I looked around the cafe and wondered, does this place amount to more than just equal opportunity bookshelves, coexistence cuisine, and good intentions? Just then, an Israeli soldier stepped through the door. He looked about 19 years old, blonde hair, home from his base for the Sabbath. He sat at an empty table, ordered coffee, and lit a cigarette. Then he pulled the Hebrew translation of the Quran from the bookshelf behind him and started to read. Nobody else seemed to take notice. Here, that kind of thing is considered perfectly normal. If anything, I thought to myself, normalcy is Jaffa Cafe's biggest success.
Daniel Estrin is a freelance reporter living in Jerusalem. It's not considered polite to invite yourself to dinner, but Peter Menzel and Faith DeLuzio did just that 600 times. To be precise, they ate 600 meals with 30 families on five continents. From China to Chad, they shopped, cooked, and ate with their hosts. Along the way, they discovered how globalization, travel, and politics affect the way people eat. Their book, Hungry Planet: How the World Eats, has recently been released in paperback. It features photographs of the different families surrounded by the food they eat in 1 week. They included a poor family from Ecuador with their guinea pigs.
They had him running around their kitchen house, their little kitchen house up in the Andes, and they were going to eat them at Easter time. This is also a family that largely eats grains and potatoes, corn, that kind of thing. The only protein they really get is a chicken occasionally and these guinea pigs.
Although they have a large flock of sheep, they're using the sheep pretty much as a bank account. So when they are between potato harvests or they need something extra, they would sell one of the sheep. They'll never eat it, though.
I'm looking at this family right now as you speak, the very big, glossy, colorful spread of this family with enormous smiles on their face. And they've got bags of grain, and it looks like plantains and carrots and all kinds of vegetables. What is this they're eating?
They're eating pretty much locally, although they do live a couple hundred miles by dirt road from the coast. So you'll see that there's some bananas and plantains in there, but and also that big thing on the left that looks like a large lump is like a 3-kilogram hunk of brown sugar.
Now, you've included family recipes in this book next to the pictures of the people with their food. And for this Ecuadorian family, you have a recipe for potato soup, and it has things like a half cup of milk if the cow is producing, and one bite-sized piece of lamb per person if available. Interesting recipe.
You know, this obviously is not a cookbook. We wanted to include a recipe, and we wanted to put it in the context of the family to really help the reader to understand what the problems are really, in terms of daily life and what they may or may not be able to eat depending on the time of year. And to me, it was much more interesting to include that information than to just sort of do the kind of recipe that we would expect here in this country. And if we didn't have the milk, then we would run out to the store and get it. But they can't do that.
Now, this family and many of the families in the book may be very poor, but they seem like they're generally eating pretty well.
They are. And if you look at the 30 pictures that are of the families, the portraits with the week's worth of food, you'll notice that most of the developing countries are much more basic in that you'll see a bag of grain, a big sack of potatoes, a lot of rice and fresh vegetables, where the further a family becomes economically proficient or sufficient, you'll see a lot more packaged foods creeping in and a lot more processed foods.
And who is it that's eating the most processed food? I imagine it's us here in this country where we're so busy and on the go all the time.
The United States, where we photographed three families, you can see that even though they're culturally diverse families, there's a white family, a Hispanic family, and a black family in different parts of the United States, their table, their cornucopia of food looks fairly similar.
Let's take a look at one of these American families. I'm looking at the African-American family on page 266, and their table in their kitchen is filled with junk food, and there's pizza and on top of that, the tables in their kitchen are literally overflowing, whereas on many other tables, the food is much more sparse.
I think that most tables in the United States would really be looking like this. What I can say is that the Revises were appalled. Once you actually sit and make a list of everything that you eat in a week, you yourself would probably be a little surprised. Rosemary and Ron, they have a very busy life. They live in North Carolina, and convenience foods were a huge part of their life. They've actually used this image of all of this fast food and everything else as sort of a catalyst for change for themselves. And I've actually seen them recently, and they've all lost a little bit of weight.
Now, the two of you traveled together to 24 different countries, and you photographed and ate dinner with about 30 different families. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, sometimes we ate breakfast and lunch, too.
Oh, okay. Just meals.
Meals, right. Eating. Everyone eats, and we thought that at the turn of the century, when we learned that there were more overfed than underfed people, we thought it would be a terrific time to document this period in the history of the world.
What do you mean more overfed? I mean, we hear so much about how so many millions of people are living off of less than $2 a day, and you're saying people are overfed?
That was the tipping point in the year 2000. There were more overfed than underfed people at that time. You know, there's more than a billion people suffering from underfed malnutrition, from malnutrition. And then there's the other more than a billion now that's suffering from related diseases due to overconsumption.
So I assume that's one of the messages you hope that people will take away from your book. Anything else important that you hope people will come away with after looking and reading?
Just a thirst for information about the rest of the world. All of our books, this is our fifth book, and it's really been the theme pretty much of all of our books, is just having a thirst for knowledge and just knowing something about life outside your own little circle and your door. I think it's endlessly fascinating.
All right. Peter and Faye, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio are authors of the book Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. To see more on the book, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. No doubt Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio were faced with some unappetizing tidbits on their travels. It's a challenge that constantly faces journalists who are covering stories in the developing world. You won't find a Starbucks or a Safeway in the remote areas reporters often travel to. So getting the story often means eating what the locals eat. And as correspondent Prue Clark tells us, that can mean anything.
No, thank you, I said, as politely as one can when being offered roast giant rat. Three dead rodents, each a foot in length, swung from the hand of a small boy who'd caught them in the bush. My host, a cranky woman who spoke not a lick of English, was offering to buy the rat for my dinner. I should have been honoured. Giant rat is a delicacy here in this central Ghana village. But instead, I did what any upstanding Westerner would do. I gagged. I'd been warned to eat everything during my four-day stay in this village, lest I offend my host. So I'd struggled through a breakfast stew of chilies and dried fish bought from a fly-covered pile, through sweet cakes greasy with palm oil and greens so bitter they tasted toxic. But everyone has a gastronomic limit, and giant rat, apparently, is mine. In my travels, I've gladly tasted exotic food. Goat head stew in Jamaica, yak yogurt in Nepal, but they were by choice. When reporting from isolated villages of Africa, there's no McDonald's. It's eat with the locals or starve. Trust me, I've chosen the latter on occasion, but when I'm desperate, I just have to close my eyes and dive in. Like the time in an isolated fishing village in Liberia, where I shared lunch with five hefty village men. I never eat with women, by the way. They just cook and serve the food and eat whatever the men leave behind. We sat on benches on either side of one huge bowl of stew. It was reddish in colour, tomato-based, I guess, with chunks of an indiscernible greyish meat, some with fur still attached. What is it? I asked, hoping to hear cow or maybe pig. Meat, came the answer. That apparently was all I needed to know. Of course, all this makes deli belly, or what I like to call the Nigerian nasties, inevitable. Thankfully, I've recently perfected a magical medical cocktail that gets me back on the job in hours. But for every awful culinary experience here, there are always two that surprise me. My staple food is red red, a stew of black-eyed peas, tomatoes and chilies. And there's Kelly-Welly, made from plantains doused in ginger, chili and cloves and fried in oil. Who knew that peanuts make a tasty soup? And freshly caught fish cooked right on the beach over an open flame with onions and tomatoes are delightful. In Africa's tropics, luscious mangoes, pineapples and coconuts grow wild. Deep in the forests of the Congo, women on the roadside sell entire baskets of juicy passion fruits for 10 cents. And they laugh in disbelief when I tell them that just one passion fruit sells for $4 back home in New York. And on one magical day last year, I tasted the fruit of the Ghanaian cocoa tree, source of the finest chocolate in the world.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, you only suck it, you don't cheat.
Right.
It's a bit mix between banana and mango, you think? Now, if I could just get a hot shower, but that's another story.
That was correspondent Prue Clark reporting from Africa. And that brings us to the end of our show today. You can find out more about the program and where to find us at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can listen to the show there, or you can sign up for a podcast if you'd like to take us with you. You can also see photos of many of the stories we featured in the program today. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Chris Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepherd, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Somando sobre ele, tangazangani.